When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
A group of attorneys known as the Fifth Street Lawyers, because of the location of the courthouse and their storefront offices, were hanging around the corridors, as usual, waiting for appointments as government-paid counsel to indigent defendants. Two of the regulars, a tall, thin attorney in a frayed sharkskin suit, and an obese, middle-aged lawyer who had once been disciplined for soliciting cases in the basement cell block, were muttering their distress. They had been tentatively appointed to represent the five accused Watergate burglars and had then been informed that the men had retained their own counsel, which is unusual. Woodward went inside the courtroom. One person stood out. In a middle row sat a young man with fashionably long hair and an expensive suit with slightly flared lapels, his chin high, his eyes searching the room as if he were in unfamiliar surroundings.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Usually I get to do the introductions of the guests on the show, but as you may have already heard, hopefully if this is your first episode, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us at One Heat Minute Productions. But I've allowed my dear friend, Maria Lewis, to help me introduce my incredible next guest. I'll start it and then I'll let her finish it because she actually reveals that guest name. We're talking about one of the most blisteringly hilarious satirists in this country, whether it's in print form, whether it's on his great series of work all across the feed, SBS. You can follow everything that he did there on his Twitter, whether it's his fortnightly sketches for the 7:30 report on the ABC, or whether it's being a TV host on Pointless, and even his own limited audio series, Riot Act, where he's kind of the narrator and the star, if you like, along with Dan Illich in the production. And I'll let the incredible Maria Lewis right now introduce him.
I just want to say, actually, I'll say two messages. We were talking about some of your guests, and I've worked with them in a journalistic capacity at so many different levels of journalists. Like, I worked with this person at this newspaper. I worked with this person at this online publication that we both hated. I worked with this person on that show at SBS, which is the case with the wonderful Mark Humphreys, who I have to say is the perfect guest to have on a podcast about All the President's Men, because he has the physical makeup and stature of a Nixon staffer that would for sure be involved in a cover-up. I remember when Trump got elected, it was like fucking, it was A, horrible and people crying in the newsroom, but B, really exciting for storytelling purposes, because we knew that we could have Mark Humphreys portray anyone of the Trump children at any time if we needed him to in a skit.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome the amazing, the hilarious, the awesome Mark Humphreys. Mark, thank you so much for being a part of All the President's Minutes.
Oh, Blake. Well, thank you for that. Although those introductions, thank you for both of them. Big shout out to the wonderful Maria Lewis. Yes, no, I do a mean Ivanka. And but you know, I was cursed with the. I think I'm prepared to say I'm a doppelganger for Eric Trump, and it's awful. It's just of all the people that you could look like. I think I pulled the short straw.
Short straw for everyday life, but a gold nugget for your particular brand of whimsy, because yeah. It's just, I mean, it is almost like you don't have much work to do, Mark. You can just like he's helping you with all the content. It's just that you just dress it up, and the sketches basically write themselves.
I wish they would write themselves. It would save me a lot of time. But yes, no, I know, I do know what you mean. They certainly, yes, the Trump family certainly offers up a little bit too much material, and I find that I tend to have to kind of just pick my spots of when to go with a Trump thing, because you know it's so well documented by the American satirists, and. I only really like to touch it if there's like an Australian angle or something specifically Eric Trump, just because, again, I don't have to spend hours in the, you know, there's no like Danny DeVito, Oswald Cobblepot kind of situation with the makeup department. So, I'll be keeping my eye on them.
Oh, so great. Well, look, let's rush into the minute because we have lots to talk about. This is a minute-by-minute examination of the incredibly prescient 1976 film directed by Alan J. Pakula and written by William Goldman from the novel, actually, by Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. It is, of course, All the President's Men. This is the sixth minute I'm going to go through with Mark as we see Base 1 to Unit 1 trying to warn some really oversized suit-wearing white-collar criminals that there is some activity in the Watergate building despite their completely obvious break-in, and that all sort of going slightly pear-shaped. So Mark and I are going to watch it with together right now. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and use that as a portal to talk about everything All the President's Men.
Base 1 to Unit 1. Base 1 to Unit 1.
We have some activity here. Silence is advised.
Shut it off.
Base 1 to Unit 1. Lights on the 8th floor. Base 1 to Unit 1. Is there anybody there? There's people. People on the balcony, armed people. Base 1 to Unit 1. Base 1 to Unit 1.
There it is, Mark. It bookends with a man standing across from Watergate in what I think is like, if that's a residential building, it is the most obvious break-in of all time, because like using torches in that darkened building, of course someone's going to see. Like even Robert Zemeckis took the piss out of in Forrest Gump and had Forrest call in the Watergate break-in, because it's so bleedingly obvious that of course they're going to get caught.
I'd forgotten that. That was I've forgotten that wonderful moment from Forrest Gump. I've got to say, a perfect minute, by the way that it bookends. I know Maria Lewis had 70% black screen or something to that effect in her minute. This is a beautiful minute. This is, starts and ends with the same guy. And I think this minute really does a very good job of kind of putting, at least for me, putting me in the position of the burglars. I was shitting myself. Yes. For them, even though they're in the wrong.
because they're completely cornered and they're outmatched. And this guy who has to pretend to be, well, ultimately is being calm intentionally. Like he doesn't want to attract attention because then obviously he might get pinched at the same time in the same action. But yeah, it's immediately like, oh, there's no way they're going to escape. I think even from the first second when they're in there, it's like there's no way they're boxed in. They're using these torches. They're coming to these windows. And once the lights start flickering on the floors around them, it's just like, oh, it's only a matter of time. These guys are pinched. That's it. There's never a second you think, like in other movies, there's like, oh, someone's going to get away. Even the guy who's like, we got to go. Like even that guy.
Yeah.
They're completely done.
Yeah. And you, because you know, obviously, you know the story. There's no, it's funny how there's the tension is that you know they're going to be caught but they don't necessarily know that you've almost got something over them. The interesting thing that you said about the white collar is white collar criminals is just, yes, it's how well dressed they are. For in my head, a burglary is a lot shabbier, but they look like they've just come from a board meeting. And then, rummage around.
It's a boozy white collar dinner somewhere, some corporate steakhouse, you know. I'll just have the rump, you know, get charged $80 for a ridiculously mediocre steak because the markup is there. Like, that's what these guys look like. And, you know, after coming out of talking 177 episodes of Heat, like, these guys don't look like professional crooks to me, you know.
Yeah, I think that's there's your problem.
It kind of feels, I want to come back to the rubber gloves because it's weird. Like, they're wearing these gloves, these latex gloves, and they're sticky taping them, presumably to withhold their identity at some point from anyone who could potentially get a fingerprint. But they're wearing these open suits, they're sweating, their hair's all over the place. It's just like, if you want to find these guys, presumably you're going to kind of know that they were there, even if it's not the fingerprints, because of all the other things that is wrong with that picture. But them not knowing that is sort of that great blissfully unawares thing that on rewatch you're just like, of course they were going to get pinched, of course. This was all blatant.
And it's not a fashion competition, obviously. But the police officers are much shabbier. They almost to me look like a rival gang, like almost like a rival burglary. And they almost sort of imagine a scenario where the two gangs meet and try to run off with the goods. But
of a dance fight with the sharks, and I know you just want to say it, Mark. You want to say these guys need to, the police and these suited people are going to come up against each other.
Well, any West Side Story reference will always go down very well with me. So, for those who don't know, I have a separate Twitter account at Mark's Musicals where I just talk about musicals.
I'm Googling it right now. I didn't, but I'm searching.
Welcome.
Oh my God.
So, yes, is there anything else that stands out? I mean, I think also, do we know what happened with the guy opposite in the other window? Was he arrested as well? I can't remember. Is he part of that? Did they dob him in? Do you know?
Well, he's part of the overarching Watergate conspiracy, but I don't know if he's ever named. And, like, I've been in preparation for this minute. I was scouring the book, like the details around the book, to see if the so-called sixth Watergate burglar was named. And I just couldn't find anything. And I'm sure with some more creative Googling, there might be some associations. But it was also like a little bit confusing because they do the whole base one to unit one, and then they call each other by another moniker on the airwaves. And so I was always wondering if there were multiple people, but obviously it seems that there's a sixth one. But yeah, no, you don't see them named. And I've read the section of the book over and over again where people are indicted there about who was a Watergate burglar, and I don't think that anyone further gets pinched because really they then become the most outer layer of the investigation. It then becomes just charting, you know, this by concentric circles, by following the money, by sort of eking out and trying to find sources who'll reveal things to them all along the way to go up and up and up. And that person might have just been, you know, any number of one of their associates.
I think one of the other things that this minute does very well is I'd forgotten, because it had been a few years since I'd watched it. I own it on DVD, but it's been a few years since I watched it, and I forgot how it's very difficult to stop watching this film in the sense of,
yes,
that's a great tense moment, and then everything that follows, although completely different in the style of tension that is created, is so thoroughly captivating that I think I've become accustomed to stopping and starting things because of, you know, it's because we can, because, yes, you know, I have two children and all the sorts of things, and you watch things bit by bit. This was something where I went, I'm going to need to go to a library and and really do this properly because I wasn't able to just walk away from it. And so I think that's a really nice tight minute that sets up the ongoing sort of tension of how they're going to unravel this. It's a good minute.
it
picked well for me.
It's also a credit to Pacula and it's a credit to William Goldman is that it is very stripped back, but it is extremely tense. You know, just overwhelming darkness, like the, you know, blinding fluorescent lights as soon as they come on, like the illumination of that and how this city seems to like be these like little caverns of darkness and then the lights come on and all these little creatures scurry around. And so it does all that beautiful stuff and really does set it up. And then we start moving down and it's only in this darkness, you know, it's in this darkness that's trying to connect, you know, the very beginnings of the film with Nixon, you know, in full light, in full glory, and the darkness that kicks this off in this little National Democratic office. But
that's a very good point. And also from a sound perspective, cutting between sort of the street sounds and the dead silence.
Yes.
And that juxtaposition, I think, is very effective as well.
Yeah, you're an audio storyteller. You know what it's like when you're putting a radio station or something like that in the background. It's all of that atmospherics that this movie does so well. It either chooses to have a lot of it or it doesn't have much at all.
The power of silence is so interesting, especially how it can be used in what I do, using it in comedy. I've been on tour recently with each year I do a show called The War On. This year, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah, so last year, The War On 2019. I imagine we'll do The War On 2020 if the planet is still here by the end of the year. And there was one section of a piece that I was doing in the show that I really believed in the line, but I couldn't work out why it wasn't landing. And Charles Firth, who created The Chase and is on tour with us, said, "Oh, Mark, I just think that pause you've got between the setup and the punchline, drag that out. See how long you can hold it." And I went, "That's interesting." And I went out there and I basically did the line and then stood there in silence and then did the punchline, and it was just, you know, it was night and day. It was completely different, huge response. And so just the effect of silence, obviously, in what I do, but the power of silence in drama in terms of creating tension, it's fascinating that you can actually do a lot by doing nothing.
Yeah, and just the stillness. And especially with these guys who are waiting for people to answer, there's nothing more powerful than just sort of saying something and waiting for a response.
Oh, yes.
The agony of responses is so great.
Oh,
And also here, we know the walkie-talkie's turned off, but our mate across the street, he doesn't. And so when he's like base one to unit one, it's a very easy filmmaking, editing, manipulation to speed that up. Because, you know, he doesn't know that they can't hear him and, you know, cutting back to the walkie-talkie that's turned off or something like that. There's a lot of tropes that you see would be used from someone who's a little bit less confident. But it's like, base one to unit one, yawning gap. Like, yawning. You could drive a bus through it. And it's like, that is so much more powerful because they're just not talking anymore. And yeah, I agree with you. It's just, silence in this movie is a huge thing. And it's one of the biggest contrasts in, say, the Spielberg, you know, loving prequel of this movie, essentially, which is The Post, is that is a movie that is richly dramatic and to the point of probably melodrama. And you get lots of music, lots of tones, lots of manipulation telling you what to do. And then you compare it with All the President's Men and it feels like you're on another planet because it's just sparse, allows for things to sit, you know, and it's not trying to tell you how to feel in any number of the scenes you're doing. It's just sort of happening and unfolding. And when there is music, it kind of comes in and swells and shocks you or, you know, tinkers in there and sort of manipulates you. But it's not constantly telling you what you need to think or what you need to feel.
I might be wrong, but I feel like, correct me if I am, the lookout is the one who tells them to be quiet. Because there's people coming, but then the lookout is also the one who's hello, talk to me.
Yes, so
I feel like he's not the best member of the team, but that's why he's in a separate building.
Look, Mark, these are not very bright guys. In the parlance of this movie, I keep thinking this at the beginning of this movie. I never thought it's like some lines just end up resonating with you with the entire film, and I'm like, These are not very bright guys. And yeah, it's really incredible. So this movie and you haven't watched it in a while, but you're a satirist, and so it's almost impossible for me to not start going down the rabbit holes with you around what really resonates with you in this movie and how it maybe influences or informs the way that you work now. Like, what are those things that really scratch you when you watch this movie, aside from this sort of perfect little bookended minute that we're talking about?
There's a few things, so I'll apologies in advance that I'll jump around, because there's a whole bunch of things that struck me rewatching it. One, for instance, is more broadly because of what Woodward and Bernstein's work ultimately, you know, contributed to in the sense of bringing down a president. I think it's created this unfortunate situation where we still believe that journalism can achieve these, you know, immense things. And I'm starting to worry now that I don't want to be too cynical, but I do wonder if that is still the case. It was funny when Bob Woodward announced that he was doing a Trump book, Fear,
yes,
in 2018. I'm sure I wasn't alone in having, at least for a moment, a thought of like, oh, this will bring down the president. Oh,
Bob Woodward's coming out, exactly. Like, the champ is here, you know, the guy who's done it before. Like, we couldn't wait. I agree. You know, as a fan of All the President's Men, I was like, oh, this book is going to be revelatory. They can't ignore it if Bob Woodward's writing about it.
Yes, exactly. So
I think both of us at that time.
Yeah, that's right. So, but I think I wonder whether anything can happen like that again, you know, in this, and I hate using phrases like post-truth and fake news and all that stuff, but in the current time period, yes, can journalism still have that impact when there's so much of the population that either is switched off from the news or doesn't trust it? And so I guess watching it, I feel sort of nostalgic for the power of the paper, the power of the front page and that type of journalism. And of course there are examples today of journalism that is achieving, that has results. I think Four Corners in Australia is a brilliant example, where the number of times that Four Corners will do a story, and for any listeners overseas, Four Corners is a current affairs
show on our public broadcaster, the ABC. Yes. And not only is Four Corners still doing it, they've like, Four Corners themselves have toppled local politicians.
Mm.
Many.
Yeah,
many.
Exactly. This is it. So it's sort of always, anytime you see what Four Corners is about to do a story on, you can put money down that there's going to be a royal commission into whatever that particular topic is. There are examples where these things, you know, can still have an impact.
You know, Mark, I mean, I know you're a kind of humble guy, so I don't mean to toot your horn, but I think it's also about, it's a tandem thing now. It's that there's not only the incredible journalistic endeavors and great publications, and like whether it's a TV publication like Four Corners, like as an institution that just has this ethos of we're going to do great stories, and the ABC just in general as a, you know, and you've worked for both our public broadcasters, whether that's SBS or ABC, it's like there are some editorial institutions in this country, we're lucky, and in other countries definitely, that they just have this rigorous journalistic ethos, and it just continues to go no matter who is trying to disrupt it. And I think also when you pair that great journalistic ethos and real reporting with some really beautiful satirical skewering now and then that sort of points people back to like, what the hell is like, why is Mark teasing this, or why is Mark saying this? And you're like, actually, no, I need to go and read about that, because if you're making such a blatant and hilarious joke about it, I think it sort of works in tandem. I think it's John Oliver does it a hell of a lot in his show, Last Week Tonight, which is when they do their deep dives on stories, they're referencing incredible journalism that's happening all across America, whether it's from the Washington Post or whether it's the New York Times or whether it's, you know, the LA Times or it's the BBC, and they'll reference all these stats and great reporting that will sort of give them and sort of use these as collations and then skewer it to death with satire as well. I think it's like, that's where I sometimes have hope, is that something that you do that goes viral that then might point, you know, another extra 1,000 or so people to a real piece of journalism. You know what I mean? At the same time,
exactly.
I think it works in tandem. I think that's heartening, because it's actually the you thing that insults someone on social media and makes it go viral and makes a topic hang around. But then it's also the in tandem, there's these other great stories that are happening on the sideline.
Yes, that's my hope, that the piece of content that I make is either rewarding people who are already in tune, people who already know what's going on, and just, you know, giving a sort of a take on it that they might enjoy, or being a gateway into that topic for people who, you know, aren't necessarily as engaged. Occasionally, I have heard people say, "Oh, I get my God, I couldn't believe when I heard this." the only news I get is from your sketches, and like, please don't do that.
Here's a disclaimer: look, watch my sketches, but that's not the only news.
Yeah,
for the love of God,
please let it be a jumping off point. But what I think someone like John Oliver does very well. And I think it happens here with The Weekly and Mad as Hell. And
Mad as Hell is outstanding, absolutely outstanding. Yeah. Weekly is very, very good. Mad as Hell has been doing, you know, is just taking that to the absurdist degree.
And I think, yes, with John Oliver, I think what John Oliver does brilliantly is it is researched to the point that it shouldn't be a substitute for the news, but if by chance you didn't watch the news, it's not a bad substitute, because there's actually some journalism. Yeah, there's actually a lot of journalism involved in putting that together, not only referencing existing journalistic sources, but their own team going out and sourcing information themselves. So, I think John Oliver's found a very good way of being a, you know, hilarious, but also providing a kind of valuable, you know, news service.
Can I ask you before you go on to your next point, I love watching your stuff, Mark, particularly because of what you invariably skewer, whether it's particularly Australian, you know, political fuckery. I'll go out there and I'll call it, that's what it is. It's Australian political fuckery, corporate fuckery that's happening in the country, and how that's interconnected with politics. I love watching it. But I wanted to ask you, in all of the things that you've covered, when you went back to watch All the President's Men, did it seem quaint in a way, more quaint now, like revisiting it when in the context of some of the things that you've covered?
I think it was only quaint. I mean, I don't know if it resonated with me from a kind of satirical standpoint. I think I saw more kind of parallels between, like, when I was at SP, actually, and even now, I'm at the ABC. I'm being in a newsroom during a major event. That hasn't changed. The sort of excitement of seeing the scene where I'm trying to think of the woman's name, but where Woodward basically drags
Sally Aitken, one of their colleagues, back into the office because she tells him that over some drinks, the actor's name is Penny Fuller. She's amazing. It's one of the best scenes in the movie.
And he
drags her back in and says, "This guy said that he wrote the Canuck letter." And it gets leads into that beautiful robot scene. It was like, I don't care you had the conversation with Sally. I care what you said to Sally.
There's always something thrilling about watching something where someone says, "Tell him exactly what you just told me." that's always, you know, oh, this is a big thing. But I never saw someone, you know, drag a colleague across an office. But I know there were moments. I do remember a day at SBS where there was a breaking story, and there was a frisson. There was an absolute energy and electricity in the newsroom, and there were people running around. And because, you know, obviously we were adjacent to it in the sense of being satirists, things would sort of trickle down to us, or you'd grab someone and say, "Hey, what's that about?" And they'd say, "Oh my God, blah 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 blah." I think it was actually a story about Wyatt. I mean, it seems like so trivial now, but I think it was that Wyatt Roy, who was an MP, a federal MP, was in Iraq and was caught in crossfire or something. That was the sort of story, and SBS I think had the scoop.
Well, that's a story. A politician stuck in the crossfire in Iraq is a story. Yeah. That's a story. It's got some legs, right, especially when it's an international exclusive.
Yeah. So that was our sort of All the President's Men moment. I mean, similarly, I was in the SBS newsroom the day of the third presidential debate between Trump and Clinton.
Mm.
And that was fascinating because it's everyone glued to the screens, and then there would just be occasional eruptions of laughter because of some idiotic thing that Trump had said. And it's so extraordinary to think how, I don't want to say naive, but how safe we felt, I guess. I mean, sorry, and maybe there are people out there who like Trump, and if you do, let me just say fuck you. But there was just a kind of it wasn't a partisan thing. It wasn't like left and right. It was just like, this guy, doesn't matter what
this is, it's got to be a joke.
It's got to be a joke.
It's too funny to not be a joke.
This guy is making a complete fool of himself against the most qualified presidential candidate in U.S. history. You know, someone who's already spent 8 years in the White House, someone who was Secretary of State. You know, there's just no way this clown. And so it was entertaining. But yeah, that was, you know, and that was something where everyone was glued to that. And so I've always enjoyed those moments, being in a newsroom and having echoes of All the President's Men. One other thing I would say about the newsroom, and this, I'm probably reading far too much into this, but I'm a huge fan.
Can I just say, you're actually I couldn't wait for someone to say it. I couldn't wait. There's always someone in one of these minute-by-minute projects that goes, I don't know if I'm reading too much into this. Let me tell you, we're about to do 138 hours on this thing. You're not.
It's a very trivial observation, but I'm a huge fan of Oliver Stone's Wall Street. Mm. I love that film. And I feel watching Wall Street, even though it's not a newsroom, but the energy of the office where Bud Fox works is, to me, very, very similar to the energy of a newsroom. And the layout feels very similar to me. And I wonder whether there's any conscious choice that Oliver Stone made in that sense, purely because there are two cast members that overlap. Hal Holbrook.
Yeah.
And James Caron. So James Caron has a very small role in All the President's Men. He's the lawyer of Stephen Collins' character, whose name has just
Hugh
escaped
Sloan.
Me.
Hugh Sloan. He's Hugh Sloan's lawyer. He basically fields a couple of questions at a press conference.
Yes. And I wondered whether, yes, it might just be pure speculation, but yeah, in my head, watching this again reminded me of the energy of Wall Street and made me go, oh God, I got to watch Wall Street again.
Look, I don't think you're necessarily wrong, because, you know, I think there's that same big dick energy of Ben Bradley and Robards,
exactly,
and Gordon Gekko, Michael Douglas. They've got that same hierarchically, you know, that omnipresence. They're just in an office, but when you're out in that layout, and it's that open sort of 70s, 80s office layout where newsrooms and mirrored, you know, because newsrooms are collaborative spaces. So like when corporate, especially like selling corporate places, needed that hum and that buzz and that vibe. But they're both got these huge shadows that are being cast over the whole newsroom with these editorial characters that are on the fringes.
Yes, but you're so right about the big dick energy. I think that is absolutely the feeling that comes across in both of those. Now, you mentioned fuckery before, and I'm glad you did, because this is a really niche observation, but it's something that I'd forgotten. When during one of the encounters between Woodward and Deep Throat, they talk about rat fucking.
Rat fucking.
And the reason that resonated for me is that one of my favorite quotes to throw into a sketch for really no reason is a quote attributed to Kevin Rudd, former Prime Minister, Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, who during the 2009 Copenhagen Climate Change Conference reportedly said something to the effect of, those Chinese fuckers are trying to rat fuck us. And it's the only other time I've heard rat fucking used. Yeah, those are the only two examples I've heard. I'm sure it's been used loads, but in my life, I've only come across rat fucking twice, and it's Kevin Rudd, and it's All the President's Men. So there's a little, that's a little connection there. So whether Rudd is a All the President's Men fan, I don't know.
I would have to say that he is. I mean, if you've seen his filibuster losing speech, which I'm sure you've watched on repeat and cackled your life away, his filibuster, election losing speech, he's a guy who has an affinity for wanting to do good in the world, and then just it all went pear shaped, right? So, rat fucking, that's our current Australian politics, because rat fucking in the context of All the President's Men, and when they were talking about Donald Segretti and his team of folk, I mean, they go into it in much more detail in the book, but it's Robert Walden's character. They're talking about messing with your opposing partners on the campaign trail, making up things, sending things out on their stationery, the Canuck letter being one of them. But I think that rat fucking is political campaigning in 2019. Like in 2019, 2020, 2016, that's what it was. It was Trump not sending out something to insult someone, going to a debate and abusing someone verbally, and the rat fucking was all out there in the open. So it just feels like it's sort of outmoded, because the rat fucking is so blatant now. You don't need to be covert. It's overt. It's right in front of us.
No, I mean, there was a U.S. congressman this week who put out a doctored image of Obama with the Iranian president, I think it was, and people called him out on it, but his response was that it was an artistic expression, and there's no accountability. The only accountability we have is at the ballot box, and voters aren't holding people accountable. So we don't have a system set up to counter the rat fucking.
Because the incentive, and it's also the cynicism of the process, which is tough. I think one of the major contrasts we're going to butt up against in this show constantly is that, that's what's even more infuriating, is in Australia, is you can vote apathetically when you're conscripted to vote, essentially. You have to vote in this country.
Yes.
You get a fine if you don't. Yeah. There's very sort of rare circumstances where you would get away with not registering to vote. And there are still people who are apathetic and go in and, their version of rat fucking is they go into the ballot and they just write F you on there, and you, and then close it and then put it in there. So in this country, it's, you're trying to hold people to account, but it's also then just all of the apathy that people just have about the political process just in general. Mm. It's so hard. And it's Trump doesn't make it, easier. He especially doesn't make it easier for anyone who voted for him, because this is a guy who promised he was going to clean the swamp and do this and build this and do that, and none of it's happened. None of it's happened.
Yeah, I think he just installed a new swamp. I think that's what happened.
an even better swamp. on the swamp.
Another random thought. William Goldman. I mean, you can't not love William Goldman. Another reason I'm a Goldman fan is that he wrote a book in the early 60s called The Season, which for theatre fans like myself is basically a Bible. It was 1967, 68, that's right. So what he did is that for an entire Broadway season from 1967 to 68, he went and saw every show on Broadway, and as either plays or musicals. And what he did is, not only did he talk about the individual shows and kind of quasi-reviewed them, but he spoke about the business of Broadway, and he broke down how ticket prices are determined, how advertising works, all these sort of things. It is even though it's now 50 years old. Yeah.
Nearly 60 years old at this point. Jesus Christ.
It's still this tome, this Bible for theatre lovers. And just, again, also just shows the versatility of Goldman's writing. I'm a huge Misery fan, personally. That's probably my favourite of his film output.
You look at his film output, and it's got movies like All the President's Men, it's got Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, and it's got The Princess Bride. It's extremely versatile, and his versatile writing. The season is great, and it's good. I had definitely heard of the season, and I'm so glad that you pointed it out. But it's like, you know, me on being a film buff on the other side is like, he wrote so many essays and books about the film industry. The big picture, adventures in the screen trade, what lies did I tell, where he was just extremely candid about the process of filmmaking and the business of filmmaking and the motivations of studio heads and advertisers and, you know, audiences leaning into different movie stars and sort of had this like very clinical, you know, and in the season, it's like very, it's almost like a sports fan-minded approach, statistical. Mm. You know, breaking down each of the elements, because sometimes the movie magic sort of keeps us blissfully focused on the text and not on the business. And I think what's great about his writing, both in the season and in all of his other essays, is like he breaks down the business. Like, this is what the business is. This is why you cast Robert De Niro. Oh, sorry. This is why you cast Robert Redford, rather. This is why you know, this is the biggest movie star of our time up until this point. This is who is going to win in the Oscars. You know, this is why they're going to win in the Oscars, because Harvey Weinstein's going to take all these people out to dinner. You know what I mean? Like, it's like he's going to campaign for it. So he was, he's such a prophetic guy. And he hated writing the script, by the way. He hated it.
Is that right? Well, why is that?
Well, this is of all the sources that I've been able to find, it's a number of podcasts and it's his own writing on it in What Lies That I Tell. He talks about, you know, firstly just wrangling the script, like getting together after he'd written Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. That's how Redford had hired him to do it. But it was a couple of different versions and people's egos wanting to influence it. So it was like him trying to craft it to find the film, to find the finished film, the different influences coming from Redford and Pakula to kind of mess with him and get him to craft it in the way they wanted it. And then even as far as Nora Ephron, who's another filmmaker and screenwriter, coming in and like submitting scenes to certain things that they kept in the final product. And so when you get down to the nuts and bolts, not much of what he actually produced in the original screenplay is gone. Like, it's all there. And you know, there was in the most recent All the President's Men Revisited documentary, it's a bit of like a Robert Redford sort of revisionist history where he says that, you know, he and Pakula just like rewrote the script, like basically rewrote everything Goldman did. But then when people, some sort of boffins on the internet, have gone back and gone, actually, you know, no, William Goldman published the scripts that he wrote. So like you haven't really done much at all. Like, a line here, a scene has changed order here, but it's the same. Like, he's written 90% of it. So he talks about this one being a real frustration because of that influence, because obviously he had to adhere so authentically to the book and to find the movie in the book, because just telling the story of the book is not the movie. But it's the mastery, I think, of him is finding the entertaining, finding the thrills, finding the process, finding the characters, and all of the restraint. And then the rest is, you know, the kind of rest is history, because there wasn't a great relationship. And particularly, I think it was in, I can't remember if it's What Lies Did I Tell or Adventures of the Screen Trade, where he talks about a bit of frustration on All the President's Men. And I think that was the, you know, motivation perhaps for Redford's later revisionist history, that he took over the writing of the script for Goldman, basically. So it's just one of those messy ones. But nonetheless.
Like Hook. Hook is one of my favorite films, and apparently there's a lot of Carrie Fisher in there. There's sort of lots of stuff going on. But
Goldman too, like, this is the thing, Mark. Secret history stuff, and you mentioned Carrie Fisher. There are countless scripts that William Goldman fixed that he doesn't have his name on. When there are countless filmmakers and screenwriters that he influenced or talked to or reviewed their work and said, get rid of this or keep that. And there are just countless people that he influenced along his massive career. And so it's just one of those funny things where, like, even though he wrote all this stuff, he genuinely, you know, he influenced a whole bunch of people as well.
I'm sure you've come across this, but any podcast interview with Aaron Sorkin is always worth listening to, just generally. But he, on a couple of them, does talk about his relationship with Bill Goldman. We'll call him Bill Goldman because, you know, we're movie
mates.
Busting. That's always worth listening to, hearing about that relationship. And just broadly speaking, Aaron Sorkin is just a fascinating writer slash, you know, filmmaker to listen to. You mentioned Princess Bride before as well, and just this is a discussion for a whole other podcast, but just off the back of Misery and Princess Bride, at some point someone needs to sit down and say what an incredible achievement Rob Reiner pulled off between 1984 and 1992, where you could say this is Spinal Tap, you could easily say is the greatest comedy of all time. You could make that argument.
Yeah, Stand By Me. If it's not the greatest, it's in top five.
It's like, in top five. Personally, I'm a Bowfinger guy. I'm a Bowfinger and Adam Sandler Badges guy. But Spinal Tap is in the top five. As is Waiting for Guffman, I also like that one.
Oh, Waiting for Guffman's so good.
Stand By Me, you could argue, is the greatest coming-of-age film of all time.
Best King adaptation too.
Right, yes.
Princess it's in the Bride. Conversation. There's only really one, like, there's kind of two others. If you're a horror fan, it's probably it. Maybe maybe Misery too, because I think that was based off of King, and maybe Christine, and those others. But the big one is Shawshank. So it's like Shawshank versus Stand By Me, and that's a conversation to be had too.
Yeah, right. And then Princess Bride, you could put it as if one of the greatest. I mean, there's a whole bunch of categories you could put it into of fantasy or family or whatever. But and then when Harry Met Sally, you could make the argument greatest romantic comedy of all time.
It's modern rom-com.
It's quite extraordinary that run. But anyway, that's a conversation for another time. But just credit. I'm just going to give credit to Rob Reiner, because I always feel like people forget just what an incredible period that was.
Well, it's so funny that you talk about that, because the director of this very film, like Rob Reiner, whose run is really kind of unparalleled. Is you've got Alan J. Pakula, who his movies at this time, he's direct, and these are just the films that he directed rather than produced. So he makes Clute, The Parallax View, and All the President's Men in a 5-year period. Like 5 years, he's got those. And then, there are others where, you know, a variety of different levels of success. Sophie's Choice was a huge movie, Presumed Innocent, Pelican Brief, but like, that's a massive to just go 1, 2, 3. Clue, Parallax View, President's Man.
Yeah,
that's a massive, runs of movies like that. And Reiner's run is a huge one. Bill Goldman. Anywhere Bill Goldman appears in any director's resume is a good movie. you're pretty blessed to have a Bill Goldman script to be working towards.
This is going to be the dumbest or one of the dumbest observations I'm going to make in this podcast. But I did something that did strike me, is I looked up Alan J. Pakula and was like, oh, what does the J stand for? And the J stands for J.
My middle name is right behind that shrub. I'll finally know what J stands for. From this moment forth, I will be known as Homer J. Simpson.
And it reminded me of that whole Simpsons episode where Homer J. Simpson goes to find out what the J stands for, and it stands for J. So I wonder whether there's a connection there between the Simpsons and J.
I can't think of a better way to get out on this show than that observation. That was absolutely outstanding. Look, the brilliant and insightful satirist Mark Humphreys has been my guest today. Mark, thank you so much for being a part of All the President's Minutes. It's a pleasure to have you on so early as a big fan, and it's been great to chat to you about all things Bill Goldman and all things this movie. So thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Thank you, Blake. Great film, great podcast.
Like the Washington Post coverage of Watergate, this podcast is a result of a collaborative effort. Thank you so much to my narrator once again, Holly McBride, who is quoting from All the President's Men, the Simon & Schuster edition. Thank you to my amazing guest, Mr. Mark Humphreys, one of Australia's great satirists. You can follow Mark because he puts all of his great stuff on Twitter at Mark Humphreys. And today, as you would have heard in the podcast, at Mark's Musicals, if you're a musical fan and you want to dine out on his references to West Side Story, amongst many other things. I've been Blake Howard at One Blake Minute on Twitter at ATPM Pod. And if you want to mail us about anything, it's mail@oneheatminute.com, or simply send us a message, page 24, New York Times. Catch you on another episode soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.